Bankless Nation, we have a special bonus episode for you today. We have Van Eck on the episode today. They've made a bold call for the price of ETH. Yes, they brought the numbers. Is ETH price going to 50K? That's what they call their bull case by 2030. They also have a base case and a bear case. We'll talk about all three of those and the variables that go into it. And I got to say, this is probably the best report that I've read on ETH price, definitely all year, maybe ever. And it's by one of the most respected institutional analysts in the game. This is Van Eck speaking today. A few things that we're going to cover. And by the way, it's just me solo today. David is out, but I've got this covered. Super excited to talk about what happens when we model ETH, the asset, as we might model an equity based on block space sales. We also talk about the base case, the bull case, the bear case for Ether, the asset. 50K is the bull case. We talk about how we got there and the variables that went into this analysis and the puts and takes. Can we model Ether, the asset, as we might model Bitcoin, the asset, or is it different in some way? How about Solana? How about Atoms? How about other alternative layer ones? We talk about that today. We also talk about what other institutional investors think about Ether, the asset. Are the institutions even here yet? Are we about to get another bull market, or are we going to have to wait? Maybe another bull market doesn't come. I asked the analysts at Van Eck those questions today. Guys, before we get into the episode, want to introduce the concept of diligence fuzzing to you. From our friends and sponsors over at Consensus, they are telling us to just fuzz it. This is next level smart contract security. They call it diligence fuzzing. And this is for Solidity developers. If you are a Solidity developer, you got to ensure that your smart contract is safe before you publish it on mainnet. Well, have you considered fuzzing it first? Consensus offers a free diligence fuzzing tool that you can access right now that will help you fuzz your smart contract before you publish it on mainnet. Highly recommended. Smart contract security needs to be our number one priority. And that's what Consensus is doing here with diligence fuzzing. If you are a developer and you need this tool, access the link in the show notes. You can find out more. At this point in the intro, I usually ask David what the significance of this episode is. But since he's not here, I'm going to answer the question today. You've heard the mental model for Ether, the asset, on Bankless before. We've talked about how to think about Ether, the asset, but we don't often have the opportunity to get into concrete numbers. Here in today's episode, Van Eck has brought the numbers. That's what's significant and exciting. And I think this episode will help you think like an investor. It'll help you reestablish your conviction on this asset class. It'll help you check your assumptions. It'll arm you with data to predict what will happen next. For instance, at one point we talk about one layer two. What happens if one layer two on Ethereum gets disproportionate market share? They become really big. Is that a good thing or a bad thing for the price of ETH? According to our analysts today, it might be a bad thing for Ether, and they give their reasons why. Another concept this model reveals, will another alternative layer one outstrip Ethereum? Will there be an Ethereum killer? This is an opportunity to look at the actual numbers that would provide a clue to that, the leading indicator of something like that happening. I also think this is an opportunity to see how institutional investors are viewing Ether, the asset. Van Eck is in a position to know. Are the institutions seeing what we see? Is there still an opportunity for retail to front run the opportunity? That's what we always talk about in Bankless. And I think there still is. So this is one of my favorite types of episodes. It's an episode that's really going to sharpen your tools as a crypto investor. And we're going to get right to it with Matthew and Patrick, the analysts over at Van Eck. But before we do, we want to thank the sponsors that made this episode possible, including our number one recommended exchange, Kraken. Go set up an account.
Kraken Pro has easily become the best crypto trading platform in the industry. The place I use to check the charts and the crypto prices, even when I'm not looking to place a trade. On Kraken Pro, you'll have access to advanced charting tools, real-time market data, and lightning-fast trade execution, all inside their spiffy new modular interface. Kraken's new customizable modular layout lets you tailor your trading experience to suit your needs. Pick and choose your favorite modules and place them anywhere you want in your screen. With Kraken Pro, you have that power. Whether you are a seasoned pro or just starting out, join thousands of traders who trust Kraken Pro for their crypto trading needs. Visit pro.kraken.com to get started today. Mantle is a brand new high-performance Ethereum Layer 2 network, built differently from the other Layer 2s you may be familiar with. Mantle is a modular Layer 2, built on the OP stack, but uses EigenLayer's data availability solution instead of the expensive Ethereum Layer 1. Not only does this reduce Mantle's gas fees by 80% compared to other Layer 2s, but it also reduces gas fee volatility. Mantle has a decentralized sequencer set, eliminating the risk of downtime and censorship on the network. And because Mantle implements multi-party computation nodes, Layer 1 settlement execution is shortened from 7 days to as low as just 1 or 2. Mantle is the first Layer 2 built by a DAO and is backed by one of the biggest DAO treasuries in the world, BitDAO. Mantle already has sub-communities from around Web3 onboarded to help the growth of Mantle, like Game7 for Web3 gaming, or EduDAO for the world of DeSci, and Bybit for TVL, liquidity, and on-ramps. Check out Mantle at mantle.xyz and follow them on Twitter at 0xmantle. Immutable is at the forefront of Web3 gaming, on a mission to bring digital ownership to every player, offering the world's best games and game development platform. Immutable lets game builders and players focus on great gaming experiences. So, build your next Web3 game on easy mode with Immutable's leading full-stack Web3 gaming platform. Its built-in UX features, like the Immutable Passport, are designed for games to scale to the next billion players coming to Web3. With Immutable, players can sign up with an email, pay with a credit card, and experience a frictionless purchase flow inside of games. So discover your next favorite game and explore a network of 150 games building on Immutable, including such titles as Gods Unchained, Guilds of Guardians, Illuvium, Ember Sword, and Metalcore. So join Web3's largest ecosystem of games and players. Build, play, and connect at immutable.com.
Bankless Nation, we are super excited to introduce our next guest from VanEck. We have Matthew Siegel. He is the head of digital assets research at VanEck. He joined VanEck in 2021 after 10 years in research investment banking. He now leads a team of 10 working full-time on crypto at VanEck. And his first hire was Patrick Bush. At least that's what my notes say. Hey, Patrick, he is an analyst at VanEck Digital Research as well. His role at VanEck is to focus on finding tokens that go up. I don't know who wrote this, but it's brilliant. That's my job too. I try to do that too. He does a lot of financial modeling around crypto assets. These two gentlemen, I believe, were responsible for the report that we're going to be talking about today. Matthew, Patrick, it's great to have you on Bankless. How you doing?
Great to see you, Ryan. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, good to see you. Good to be here.
It's good to have you here. It's good to have you writing like this in this space. I think David and myself on Bankless, we've been on a quest to actually try to understand this asset called ETH, Ether, the asset that Ethereum produces. And I think you guys have done a fantastic job in this report. And I almost feel like we should just dig right into the report. I've got a lot of side questions for you, but like it kind of starts here. And here's the report. I'm going to show it on screen. Ethereum price prediction. 11.8K, that's almost 12K by 2030. And here's the opener for me that just kind of like hooks the reader right into this. In light of Ethereum's recent hard fork, which allows users to withdraw staked ETH, and in our view, creates a major new competitor to UST bills, we revisited our Ethereum estimates, and this is the report. A major new competitor to UST bills. How dare you? That sounds so audacious. Matthew, over to you. How can you say something like this in a report like this?
Well, we are an audacious shop. VanEck is a macro shop. We were founded in 1955 with a history of trying to manufacture innovative new products that will capture the investment zeitgeist. And in the 1970s, that was gold stocks, believe it or not, right? Gold had been illegal to own for 3 decades. And the founder of this firm got conviction that something was going to change. And he pivoted an international mutual fund into almost entirely gold stocks in the early 70s. So he was an Austrian economist with a hard money bent. And that mutual fund ended up being the best performing mutual fund in the country throughout the decade of the 1970s. And the firm's DNA was built around that ethos, which is going off the gold standard is going to have unintended consequences. It might take a decade, it might take 5 decades, but here we are. And we are on the hunt and have been on the hunt for alternative stores of value that will retain the characteristics of hard money during uncertain times. So the founder who did that is deceased, but his son, Jan van Eck, now owns and runs the firm. And he got conviction in 2017 that Bitcoin could be a major competitor or alternative to gold. And we began investing our gold profits into BTC, into ETH, into venture capital investments in the crypto ecosystem and startups. And we have a number of products that we offer to investors and also off of our own balance sheet that have helped us gain insight and a network and some confidence in the space to try to model something like ETH. So we first took a crack at this in 2021. That was before the hard fork. To proof of stake. And we staked a de minimis portion of our funds after the hard fork last September. And now with the Chapella upgrade, we really got a lot more conviction. We've increased our staking by an order of magnitude. And what gave us the conviction to do that is the fact that you can now withdraw. So a lot of the institutional money managers are operating on a monthly calendar. Our private funds get subscriptions and redemptions monthly. And it's crucial to be able to withdraw your staked digital assets in order to satisfy your customer redemption requests. Hopefully we don't have too many of those, but should they come. So when Chapella came, we thought it would make sense to revisit our estimates in light of the consensus mechanism changes and see what price target came out. So that's what Patrick and I have done.
Yeah, it's so cool here. And I'll say this to the Bankless listener, hearing financial analysts use the term Chapella just brings like a lot of warmth to my heart. I mean, these are like esoteric Ethereum hard fork names, and that's how closely this group is kind of paying attention to it. And I think that comes out in the model. I want to ask more questions in the background of Van Eck, because I know it's a trusted name in the institutional space, but I feel like a lot of crypto folks don't know too much about it. So we'll get to that in a minute. But I want to throw the same question to Patrick. So this a major new competitor to UST bills, calling ETH that. Okay, Patrick. Did Matthew put you up to this? Like, how did you have the audacity to write this in a report? Is ETH really a competitor to T-bills? What makes you say that? And how does that sound to the typical institutional investor? I'll throw that one to Patrick.
Yeah, I think Ethereum represents the Gordian knot of finance. At least all crypto does. Whoever can figure this out controls the future of finance, in my opinion. And I don't think that's too far to say. I think a really interesting point to look at is the way we see this is it's accruing a lot of value from use case more than monetary premium. The monetary premium comes in and changes the multiple more than anything else. I think that's kind of how we view it. Other institutions do not view it in such a way. They view it more as an asset that's similar to like a really high beta NASDAQ type stock. We see it as that, but also more.
Okay, well, that's good. Before we get back to Van Eck, then maybe since you've opened the door, Patrick, let's talk a little bit more about the model itself and the numbers here, which are very precise. So we've got 11.8K by 2030, and that's one of the cases pictured here. But I'm going to pull up the full chart here. This is Ethereum revenue and price targets. We've got today what the price was at the time of this report, you know, Ethereum revenue that we're looking at, and that's where you're deriving the price target. But around today, we've got the bottom here, $1,900. That's what ETH is trading at approximately right now-ish, although I haven't checked the price in the last 5 minutes. We could be over under by, you know, 25% or something because it's crypto. We've got the base 2030 case of 11,849. We've got the bear case, which I don't like to look at, but $343 for the price of ETH. And we've got the bull case of 51K. All the dates there by 2030. If you're listening on the podcast, you can't see this. I encourage you to go check out the report in the show notes or take a look at the YouTube so you can get the visual here. And the way you're modeling this, as I understand it, to your point, Patrick, is you're basing this on revenue? On cash flows, this almost looks like the way you might model an equity of some sort. So I think the substance of this report, to your point, Patrick, ignores monetary premium entirely. We'll come back to monetary premium, what that might mean. I think we're looking at this as a cash flow type asset. I guess similar in some ways to a piece of property or an equity or something like this, something that can be modeled as an asset that produces cash. Can you talk about this a little bit more? And let's talk about how you're actually able to try to predict the revenue, because I think it breaks down to categories. So I'll throw this one to you first, Patrick, and we'll come back to Matthew.
Yeah, of course. Maybe I'll just take the first part, because there's a top-down element and then there's a bottoms-up element. And the top-down element is, what are the principal end markets that intermediate transfer of value? So we divide into three. There's finance, which covers like banking and brokerage and lending. There's metaverse, which encompasses gaming, social networks, advertising, and then there's infrastructure, which is, you know, decentralized storage, decentralized compute. Those are the principal end markets, and we look at what are the revenues that are being generated by those end markets today, and we make some initial assumptions as to what percent of the value in each of those end markets will be intermediated by open source blockchains. So that's a starting point.
I see. And how did you break that down in Ethereum like transactions? How did you determine, you know, which of those, like which portion of this is attributable to finance, banking, payments versus, is this a whole like total addressable market type of analysis here? Okay.
Yes. So the total addressable market is divided into those three segments: finance, metaverse, and infrastructure. We look at existing business models and how much revenue they're producing in those three end markets. And then we make some admittedly unknown assumptions about what percent of that revenue opportunity can be captured by open source blockchains. So just to dimension that, in the case of finance, our base case, we're only assuming that 5% of all banking, brokerage, lending, payments activity, the current revenue stream, only 5% can be or will be addressed by open source blockchains. In the case of metaverse, where we incorporate social media as well as gaming, the estimates are much higher, 20%, because we think new markets will be born off of this technology and new use cases. And then for infrastructure, a more modest 10%. Think of that as the percentage of like AWS or Azure market share that might be chipped away at by decentralized alternatives, which right now might be more costly, but provide other use cases. So it's with those penetration levels, I guess, that we kind of set the TAM. And then to what extent can Ethereum address those end markets? What are the possibilities that Ethereum can take a meaningful market share of those penetration? That's where the kind of the line by line estimates come in, and I'll toss it over to Patrick for that.
Yeah, so like the way that we think about this is that these end markets have this large revenue base, and going into the future, they're going to look at crypto as an opportunity both to reduce costs and find new revenue opportunities. So we thought like a logical way to think about a take rate was the construction of how that business would unfold in terms of what they would pay. So in our model, we talk about what current businesses that deploy to blockchain, like Uniswap or Aave or Compound, are paying in terms of block fees versus like what they accrue in revenue. And so we thought that'd be like a logical split. One of the things that this looks at is it says, okay, the transaction revenue is going to have some sort of take rate. We don't precisely know what that take rate will be and why. And that gets a little bit more into the modeling going forward. Like one of the problems we run to in our model is if you see significant execution use case on Ethereum, you have substantial burn going forward. And we're not sure if that's kind of a way to look at the ecosystem being value positive for burning substantial amounts of supply. Like in some years, if you have a massive adoption or massive growth in adoption, you might burn 20 to 30% of the supply. And so we don't really know precisely how the value will be accrued by blockchain, but transaction seems like the best point for it. But that's kind of like the starting point. So businesses are going to deploy to blockchain, or they're going to save costs on blockchain, or a combination of both. And some of that will accrue value to Ethereum.
Can you talk about like the current state of Ethereum? Because I think some people aren't aware that Ethereum basically produces revenue today, right? They haven't even really looked at Ethereum from this perspective. So how do you get the numbers in the today column over here?
Yeah, that's simply the gas usage. So we looked at total gas usage going back a year. And then using Artemis data, we were able to segment the different use cases that are currently using gas in Ethereum. So looking at finance, banking, and payments, we found the protocols or applications that logically fit into those segments for an estimate of what the percentage breakdown of the current usage of the chain was. And so if you extrapolate that further, you look at, okay, what's their burn rate versus what's the base rate, the burn rate versus the tip fee? That's kind of how we looked at it. So we include that as transaction revenue. Next line item was MEV revenue. Looking at the MEV revenue was a little bit difficult to estimate. There's various sources like Flashbots and others, but we figured long term there'd be some sort of take rate on the assets, and that would kind of mirror something you'd see in TradFi, looking at like something like the CME Group. In the relation to prop traders, that's kind of how I got my estimates for long-term MEV was, okay, how much capital is deployed on the blockchain and what's the approximate revenue of these proprietary trading firms?
What units am I in right here? So if I go to Ethereum total revenue today, I see 2,539. What is that?
That's $2.5 billion. So we have today's annualized revenues for ETH at 2.5 billion, growing in our base case to 51 billion in 2030. And you're right that we're looking at this as a traditional cash flowing equity, so to speak. So we take that revenue, we tax it, and then we discount it back to today at a weighted average cost of capital of 12%. Which we get by analyzing Ethereum's beta to equities over the last number of years.
But that's the best part of this whole thing, though. Like the margins are enormous. Like this kind of business
Right.
model is like very high cash flow. Like there's a ton of value that comes from this directly in cash. That's why I think it's a very exciting asset class compared to like a traditional company that has large amounts of overhead. Like you don't see any of that here.
And to the point on kind of monetary premium, our terminal valuation. So, what multiple on that revenue number will investors pay in 2030? That's kind of the $100 trillion question, we hope. And we're assuming that the market will pay something like, 30 times free cash flow.
Okay.
So that equates to like a 3% yield, which is something that feels very normal. And
Yeah,
to
how does that
those
compare to
who,
equities? 30 times free cash flow.
it's a growth stock.
Like similar to like a Netflix or a,
Yeah,
Amazon or
probably
something.
higher, a little bit higher than those names. So in a speculative, leverage-driven bull market in which, like, say, emerging market consumers are just desperate to get their hands on a hard asset that is different from the dollar and willing to borrow to do so, like, could that 30 times free cash flow go to 300 times? Maybe. Like if you look at an asset like gold, that essentially has no free cash flow except for a de minimis stream. If you lend your gold out, you can earn a small stream of income that may cover your storage costs. Gold's free cash flow is not 3% at all, right? It's maybe an order of magnitude lower than that. So to those who look at this and say like, oh, it's too conservative, maybe that's the reason is we're not assuming leverage-driven bubble conditions. This is more about the cash flow.
That's the beauty of this model. That's what I really like about this. And so I want to make sure that listeners understand this so far. So today, on an annualized basis, we have Ethereum total revenue that we see of $2.5 billion annualized. Okay. Transaction fees, that is the gas fees essentially, make up $1.9 billion. The team at VanEck have split this into a few segments, basically, and you can kind of do that, the finance, banking, payments, the metaverse infrastructure. Those are the subsegments that compose that $1.9 billion in ETH transaction fees. But that it doesn't stop there because we also know bankless listeners about this thing called MEV. Of course, this is block builder revenue and sort of the kind of the take rate you can make as an MEV block builder. That's $497 million annualized. We have this other category.
That one is really hard to estimate. We're not sure
It
what
is,
that
yes.
is. Like
Yeah.
500 million is like a decent ballpark, yes, but it's really hard to know how that's going to play out going forward with regulatory concerns, and what users want to pay. Because at the end of the day, that's just contention for state, right? Like you're looking at block space you need it now. that's what you're willing to pay, essentially, right?
Yeah, I mean, Justin Drake came on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. Bankless listeners may have caught that episode. And so basically, the summary of that episode is, what does Ethereum sells a product? What product does it sell? It sells blocks. And what you can buy in those blocks is either congestion fees. So that is purchase the actual block, get your transaction in the block, and there's a overcharge for congestion fees. Those are gas fees. And then contention, which is block ordering, right? So Ethereum sells blocks. Congestion, contention, that's what you pay for. That's what the market demand is. And that's what's reflected here in transactions and MEV. And to Patrick's point, we don't quite know. It's very difficult. We don't have enough data points to really model what MEV revenue is going to be in the future. But right now we can see it. Maybe it's something like $500 million annualized. This other category, though, Ethereum security as a service, that's the third leg of the stool here of Ethereum revenue drivers. Explain this category. What does that actually mean? Is that different than selling block space? Because it's not monetary premium. It's something else. What is this category?
So that's taking the approach of looking what Eigenlayer is doing and extrapolating that as a new value accrual to ETH. So the idea is like, okay, maybe you can take the ETH token, you can use it to do everything from securing a new blockchain, maybe securing an oral network, maybe looking at some kind of contractual agreement where Ethereum is the collateral. Like, so there's this massive new use case that you can take with something that you know has value. And that's where we get this Ethereum security as a service. And we derive that value from what we think the opportunity cost would be for not staking ETH times a multiple. So we give it a multiple because we think, okay, well, if you're going to use maybe Eigenlayer, or maybe even if you enshrine the ability to have ETH security service within the protocol, there's going to be some kind of like, there's going to be some kind of opportunity cost to that. And so that's where we get those figures from.
You guys are doing your homework. So this is basically restaking yield is sort of what we're seeing here and the potential for that. And it's zero to date, but we're seeing some growth here. And I think these numbers are somewhat conservative by the year 2030 and what this could be, because it's somewhat of an unknown. Okay, so we have 2.5 million in annualized revenue, basically in block space sales for Ethereum, and that's today. And just to refresh us on the base case for this, in order to get to almost a $12,000 ETH price by 2030, you're assuming total Ethereum revenue gets to $50 billion, $51 billion annualized. That is the base case here. And some might argue a kind of a conservative case, sort of depends. You also have the bull case, which we could get into. But I just want people to understand the mechanics of this model is not unlike modeling cash flows for a stock. Like that, there's no voodoo here. It's just like you're taking this product in this network, which produces blocks, and you're projecting the sales moving forward, and you're doing a discounted cash flow of what those sales might be. It's not that complicated. I guess I'm wondering high level how this type of model lands with institutional investors who look at this asset. Because I think if you try to model other crypto assets for monetary premium, or even like you guys have been doing this since the 1970s, it sounds like, try to model gold. You're like, there are no cash flows for gold. And that's the way we've sort of had to model Bitcoin in the past, and even people tried to apply that to Ethereum. This is a departure from that. This is much more kind of the way you might look at an equity. How is this landing when you talk to institutional investors or like, you know, serious financial analysts about this? Are they seeing the picture here? Are they in disbelief? Like, how does this land?
Ryan, I think you make a good point about the valuation of gold, for example, and how commodities are usually valued, which is what's the marginal cost of production, right? Like if the price falls below X, then some number of producers of that commodity will not have the money to keep digging the shovel in the ground and they'll have to shut down. That will decrease supply and bring the market back into balance. And with ETH's transition to proof of stake, like that type of analysis is no longer as relevant. Because the cost of goods sold, like the electricity, the need for electricity went down dramatically. And now we have to really look at what are the underlying cash flow of this asset. And that's why it's been so gratifying to see the performance of ETH supply since the transition of proof of stake and the deflationary tendencies, the fact that ETH earnings are now so solidly positive, and that gives us the ability to do this type of cash flow analysis. But there are a few drivers in the model that move the needle pretty dramatically that I think maybe we should chat about, because we did have to make some assumptions about, you know, what is the value capture that accrues to the L1 versus the L2. Because you'll see in this model that Patrick has, I think it's 95% of all the transactions happening on the L2s, right? And if you have just a handful of dominant L2s, they might have better bargaining power to take a higher percentage of the value from ETH. Whereas if that tail is extremely long, then the balance of power might shift a little bit. So it might be instructive just to have Patrick kind of lay out
That's really smart.
where we landed with
So
those
let's
assumptions.
talk about those assumptions, because I think that drives it. And while we're getting there, let me just set the context. So the base case by 2030 is 50 billion per year in annualized Ethereum total revenue, but there's also a bear case here, which is only 2.5 billion in annualized revenue, which is basically flat from where we are now, only that's in 7 years. That's by 2030. If we do that, the model spits out a number that I don't like so much, which is an ETH price of $343, quite low. And that could happen too. That's on the table too. Then we also have the bull case by 2030. If you dial all the numbers up, which Patrick is going to explain for us the difference between bear and bull case, but if you dial everything up and you get $136 billion in annualized revenue, we get an ETH price target of 50K. All right, now we're talking. In 7 years, an ETH price of 50K. That's if you want to go extremely bullish on this asset. So, okay, Patrick, get into the variables that really drive this and kind of the assumptions behind the model that separates the bear case from the base case and the bull case.
Yeah, sure. One thing I want to mention, though, I think one of the most unpalatable things to the whole model before we go in deeper is the MEV construct. So when you talk to institutional investors, the initial reaction is, oh, that's front running, right? You're ordering transactions and doing things as you see fit, and then sorting orders as you want to. And so we make in this piece a logical analogy. This is essentially like a supermarket monetizing shelf space, where you walk into a supermarket, you look at the different shelf at eye level, you look at what's below you, and there's a premium to things that are eye level versus things that are below you. And there's a reason why that's monetizable, right? Because it's the first thing you see. And that's similar to what you see here, I think, on Ethereum. It's kind of like the way we look at it, if that makes sense.
I should also, and I'm going to toss it back to you, Patrick, to actually answer Ryan's questions, which we're not doing very well.
I'm
But
not there yet.
like, how is this landing with institutional investors? The stage here is that in the U.S. there is no institutional investment. It's family
Really?
offices, it's rich people, but the typical institutional buyers, which are the wirehouses, right? The brokers, the independent advisors, they're not allocating to crypto. Full stop.
Why? Why?
Because they can't, because this SEC is hostile to the space and has proposed rules specifically around the custody of digital assets that make it impossible for a bank with retail customers to offer crypto projects.
So it's really regulatory uncertainty right now. Is that true in just the US, or is that also globally true? Would you say institutions aren't allocating here?
It's especially true in the US, but it is largely true globally that the traditional distributors of financial products are banks, and they are not in this game at all. So that's the hurdle we have is like, okay, well, if we can't onboard institutions into proof of stake crypto, then we have to rethink what an institution means. And that's why, like, personally, I'm quite focused on Bitcoin adoption as legal tender, Bitcoin as a reserve asset. And we have done a lot of research on what are the types of countries that might adopt Bitcoin under those circumstances. And then we ask ourselves, well, what about Ethereum? Why wouldn't they adopt Ethereum? And I think it comes down to time horizon and the types of countries. If you're a country that is extremely poor in human capital, but you are rich in energy capital, then it makes sense to try to monetize some of that energy by mining Bitcoin. And then you can sell that Bitcoin and build whatever physical infrastructure that you want. If you're a country that is rich in intellectual capital with the wherewithal to maximize the use of the Ethereum blockchain by staking, restaking, asset creation, like all the types of smart contract functionality that Ethereum has to offer, you know, that's a different type of country. That's a country that is quite advanced from a technology perspective. And maybe those are the countries that are going to be buying ETH for their central bank reserves. That's not the types of countries that are likely to acquire Bitcoin for reserves. So I personally, I think we're just a little bit further off on the adoption of ETH as an institutional asset at the state level. And we're in this pause where the world is waiting to see what's going to happen in the US from a regulatory perspective. And until we get that clarity, ain't no banks that are going to be buying Ethereum anytime soon.
That's really good perspective. And before we kick it back to Patrick, I just want to kind of finish that thought. So when I ask you the questions about like, how are the institutions thinking about this? And as if if you could write the perfect report or explain Ether the asset better, that suddenly institutions would pop aboard. And you're saying that's not it at all. They ain't touching it because we don't have the regulatory clarity. You might get the family offices and the high net worth individuals kind of more interested through a report like this. But for the institutions, something like this, understanding an asset like Ether to this level is not going to get them interested in the space. For that, we actually need more regulatory clarity, particularly on the banking level worldwide, and maybe most particularly in the US. Is that a good summary, Matthew?
I agree with that take.
All right, more work to do, but great news for you, Bankless listener. Of course, none of this is financial advice. It never is, but this is a program all about front running the opportunity. If the institutions aren't here, then maybe retail gets a shot at this one. Patrick, let's talk about the difference though in the variables between the base case and the bear case and the bull case. What is the bear based on? Like, what are the dials that make the most difference in this model and take us from $300 ETH to like 50K ETH?
The biggest principal components to this is the understanding of what the underlying markets will do in terms of adopting crypto. So as Matthew mentioned earlier, we're seeing a base case where 5% or so of revenue of banking is applied in some way to crypto and public blockchain. So that'd be the base. And so we dial it up a notch in our bull case to, let me look real quick to make sure, to 10%. Likewise, we do the same thing with each of the other categories, metaverse, infrastructure. The bear case, we pull that down to 1%, 5%, and 1% respectively. And the idea behind that is that we see regulatory climate or adoption curve failing in each of those. And so that's kind of like the first construct of this model. The way to think about it is it's basically a waterfall, and Ethereum's got its cup at the end of it. And each level to get there is how much of its take rate it is. So the first level will just be what's the adoption of those underlying block of those underlying businesses. The next is, okay, what is the logical take rate? What's the take rate and what kind of revenue will Ethereum get from those places? This is transactions. And so we see something like finance, banking, and payments, whether it's finding new revenue opportunities or reducing costs, that would be 3%. And so then the next level down is, okay, we see the crypto market taking that kind of percentage. What percent of the crypto market is Ethereum? And so that's the third case. And then so for each of the bull, bear, and base cases, we tweak Ethereum's market share to reflect that outcome. So in the bear, hyper bearish scenario, not only is the end market's not using blockchain, but Ethereum has a very small market share. And so that's like in the transactions category. The layer two settlement category, which feeds in the transactions, kind of also reflects this. So we think about like the value capture of Ethereum and the L2s Matthew mentioned earlier. It depends upon the structure of L2s. Our assumption in the base and in the bull case is there's thousands of interchangeable L2s that don't have any real way to differentiate themselves. They're just using Ethereum as a blockchain to settle. Ethereum essentially is a monopoly. There's no real differentiation that takes place at L2. And so in that kind of scenario, you can see the cut rate that Ethereum could take of those settlements would be much, much higher, or the underlying businesses. So that's kind of like the basic idea for how it works. MEV, that's also going to be tied to just generally how much of adoption rate of those underlying businesses. In that case, it's just going to be digital assets on blockchain. So when we think about like how MEV works, it's really just how much on-chain activity is, and that's a reflection of how many assets there are. So that's kind of like the base and how we see this.
Okay, make
When we
sure
do
that.
one of these models, in our base case, like we think there are a lot of winner-take-all characteristics to digital platforms, right? We've seen that in Web2, that the dominant platform tends to take 70%+ market share, and the top 1% of creators on that platform often take 90% of the economics. And we think that our base case is that that is going to be even more true in Web3. And so when we model one of these tokens, in our base case, we assume that Ethereum will take 70% market share of all open source blockchains. And when we do our models on Solana, like that, our base case is that Solana takes 70%. On Atom, that Atom takes 70%. And then we see what type of upside we get when we put in those assumptions. And we look at owning each of these tokens as basically we're owning a bunch of call options that each protocol will become the dominant protocol, even though it's impossible that they all could do so. And then we manage our position size based on what type of upside we see. Does that make sense?
It does, and it's really smart, actually. It's a good way to look at this, I think.
Learning about crypto is hard. Until now. Introducing MetaMask Learn, an open educational platform about crypto, Web3, self-custody, wallet management, and all the other topics needed to onboard people into this crazy world of crypto. MetaMask Learn is an interactive platform with each lesson offering a simulation for the task at hand, giving you actual, practical experience for navigating Web3. The purpose of MetaMask Learn is to teach people the basics of self-custody and wallet security in a safe environment. And while MetaMask Learn always takes the time to define Web3 specific vocabulary, it is still a jargon-free experience for the crypto-curious user. Friendly, not scary. MetaMask Learn is available in 10 languages with more to be added soon, and it's meant to cater to a global Web3 audience. So, are you tired of having to explain crypto concepts to your friends? Go to learn.metamask.io and add MetaMask Learn to your guides to get onboarded into the world of Web3. Hiring people worldwide, paying them in crypto, providing them access to benefits, it all's so complex. But it doesn't have to be. Complying with labor laws, payroll rules, tax obligations, and crypto regulations in every country that you employ someone is difficult, time-consuming, manual, and costly. And it's drawing more and more attention from regulators and governments. But there is good news. Toku is here. Toku is the first employment and compensation platform for the crypto industry that makes this easy. Toku helps you hire employees or contractors and pay them in fiat or crypto legally, compliantly, and with all the taxes handled in over 100 different jurisdictions. So whether you're an early stage company with just a team of two, or you're an enterprise with 200, Toku has a solution that meets your needs. Toku is already working with the leading companies in the space, Protocol Labs, Hedera, Gitcoin, and many more. So transform your employment and token payroll operations with Toku. You can reach out to Toku at toku.com/bankless or click the link in the show notes. Introducing ETHX from Stater. ETHX is a liquid staking token designed to maximize rewards, all while securing Ethereum. With Stater, you can run an Ethereum node with just 4 ETH, an 85% lower capital requirement versus the 32 ETH required for solo staking. With Stater's 4 ETH nodes, you can get a 35% average higher yield, since you charge fees to those who use your node to stake their ETH. By running a node with Stater, the ETHX staking derivative token can get minted on your validators and can flow into the world of DeFi, which Stater is actively building integration and partnerships into to increase the utility of ETHX. Stater allows for both permissioned and permissionless nodes to join the network, maximizing its potential scalability for ETHX while preserving the values of decentralization and openness behind its liquid staking token. Go to staterlabs.com/eth and sign up to get access to the Stater staking protocol. Arbitrum One is pioneering the world of secure Ethereum scalability and is continuing to accelerate the Web3 landscape. Hundreds of projects have already deployed on Arbitrum One, producing flourishing DeFi and NFT ecosystems. With the recent addition of Arbitrum Nova, gaming and social dApps like Reddit are also now calling Arbitrum home. Both Arbitrum One and Nova leverage the security and decentralization of Ethereum and provide a builder experience that's intuitive, familiar, and fully EVM compatible. On Arbitrum, both builders and users will experience faster transaction speeds with significantly lower gas fees. With Arbitrum's recent migration to Arbitrum Nitro, it's also now 10 times faster than before. Visit arbitrum.io, where you can join the community, dive into the developer docs, bridge your assets, and start building your first dApp. With Arbitrum, experience Web3 development the way it was meant to be. Secure, fast, cheap, and friction-free.
So just to make sure I'm unpacking this, so we've got kind of like three layers to this analysis at a high level for Ethereum, but you could broaden this to any blockchain that sells blocks, which is all of them, if you ignore monetary premium, right? And you just focus on kind of the revenue generation side of it. And you've got like, okay, how successful is crypto in worldwide adoption in like solving actual real use cases as a percentage of the total addressable market in the metaverse and payments and all that we're doing with finance? How much does crypto kind of eat the banking world, if you will? That's your first level of analysis, and you have to put some assumptions on that. And then your second level is, okay, how much of the market will Ethereum actually dominate, right? So we've got chains that sell blocks, smart contract blockchains, maybe Ethereum, and you said in your base case is like 70%. Is that what I'm looking at? The terminal market share, 70%. Yep. In the bear case, it's 15%. In the bull case, it's 90%. And then the final variable, it sounds like, or the big driver of this is really, make sure I understand this, Patrick, is it how many L2s there are? And basically, if there's a large number of L2s, not very concentrated, it's kind of a multipolar type world out there, then Ethereum does better in that world. But if there's a few concentrated L2s, the idea is they'd have greater bargaining power. Maybe Ethereum is not able to charge kind of the block space fees that it would hope to in selling its product. And so that kind of world would be a bit more bearish for Ethereum. Is that the third, spot on the waterfall here?
Yeah, the third spot is actually like 1% of those underlying revenues that Ethereum accrues in some way. So we said before that banking would be like roughly 3% of that revenue base that is settled on public blockchain. And then the fourth layer would be the breakdown split between L2s and Ethereum. Ethereum is an ecosystem. It's an execution-centric roadmap for the L2s. For Ethereum itself, it's becoming more a settlement layer. So the idea is that, okay, like that next construct is, okay, like the transactions will happen on the L2s. The L2s have to pay fees. How does that breakdown occur? What does it look like logically? And as you cited, that just reflects like what the dynamic of the political economy, for lack of a better term, is between the L2s and L1s. If it's similar to like, you know, an empire with lots of satraps. The satraps are the L2s. If like the satrap becomes really, really big, maybe they push around the boss and say, hey, like, we're going to not pay as much tribute. Like, that's kind of how we see it.
Okay. So for Ethereum, you see it as being, bearish if one particular L2 gets too big, then.
I would almost argue it's in Ethereum's favor to push lots of non-differentiated L2s, like make sure they have as much tooling, as much ability to access block space as possible, and make sure that nothing is enshrined with an advantage. That comes into context. I mentioned that because of the Arbitrum buying Prismatic, and mm-hmm. there was something interesting there long-term. Not precisely sure, but it looks like it's the start of some kind of capture, and that's something that worries us.
Have you guys done any analysis on L2 tokens themselves, or is that kind of a next layer? It sounds like you've done some of the similar analysis on other layer one tokens. How about L2s?
Most of our deep dives have been on either layer ones or application specific projects like DYDX as an example. We have not done one of these models for L2s, and I think there's just more uncertainty around how that's going to play out, and the market caps are smaller, and there was a considerable amount of farming and kind of artificial activity that we want to see play out before we make a big bet on the L2s here.
Ryan, to go further, like one of the things that we're really interested in is looking at how the addresses churn from using Ethereum exclusively to using L2 exclusively. Mm. And that's something we're kind of looking at right now, because right now what you see is you see a lot of users on daily active user counts and on value, but you're not really sure like, okay, like are people really migrating their execution to the L2 for sure? That's something that we're doing right now as a long-term analysis.
Would you guys model Bitcoin this way, or can you model Bitcoin this way, or do you have a different model for that?
We really look at Bitcoin as a distinct asset. So in our token strategies, they are ex-Bitcoin. We see Bitcoin as a competitor to gold, and we've been valuing it based on a percentage of the gold market cap. Now, the fee dynamic in Bitcoin has changed dramatically, right? It's an order of magnitude. Bitcoin transaction fees were 2% of issuance a few months ago, and now it's 20%. So there is a possibility. We'll have to see how this develops with some of the L2s that are being built on Bitcoin. But if the cash flow story changes, then we would look at it in a different way. But for now, we're looking at it as a very different type of asset.
This is too simple to say Bitcoin is kind of like modeled in the same way gold is, and Ether is modeled as the same way what? I mean, in the intro, you said a new competitor to T-bills. Can you compare Ether to the bond market? Is Ether the internet bond? Or, I mean...
No, it's the Philip Morris, right? It's the high-yielding equity, okay? Well, hopefully not as toxic, but, right. Dividend-paying asset that can be held over a number of different time horizons.
What do you think's bigger? Is the TAM... I guess, I mean, it seems like you could also make the case to also model Ether in the same way you model gold, too. Have you ever looked at it from just a pure moneyness perspective, or do you just don't think it takes that kind of adoption path? Like, do you need to choose one or the other, or could you do a hybrid model where you do this to get the kind of the base level of Ether, and then you add this gold-like monetary premium aspect of it over here and kind of combine that analysis to get a synthesized analysis for this? Does that even make sense?
I personally think that by introducing the restaking business line, we are already assuming some moneyness, right? Because that ETH is going to be reused by, and it could be slashed validating another chain. And so it is a form of leverage. It is a form of moneyness to even have that exist. It makes the entity more levered, and our cash flow multiple should incorporate the moneyness, right? So that goes back to like my comments at the beginning. Like, we're assuming 30 times cash flow for this. If it went to 300, that would be more like, that would be a gold type situation. We just think that that's unlikely to happen in the near term, although the team debates it, you know, internally. We all have different views on this. I think it's less likely to happen because I don't think a nation state is going to be buying Ethereum, because I don't think there's the same stranded energy dynamic that there is in Bitcoin. Like, why would you buy ETH if you have stranded computer devs who have no Web 2 options to work on? So let's stuff them all into Web 3 and then put our central bank reserves behind that network. I just think we're many, many years off from that, whereas for Bitcoin, the opportunity is a nearer term. But, you know, Patrick may disagree, others may disagree.
So even within the Van Eck team that you've created, there's kind of like this question, there's debate of how much monetary premium should Ether have versus Bitcoin, which is, I think, the entire market's trying to figure that out, quite honestly. I don't think the market's taken a position on it yet, and we'll have to see. So what are people saying? What are the arguments for Ether to have more monetary premium that you're hearing in your team, Matthew?
Patrick, maybe I'll, you know, you were kind of rolling your eyes as I was giving my bullish Bitcoin spiel there. Like, maybe you have a more of an ETH maxi take than I do.
Well, I mean, I think like, if you look at it just money by itself, like, Bitcoin definitely has a monetary advantage and a monetary premium. It has it built right in the code, only 21 million. It's immutable, and that's very powerful. I think what Ethereum's value proposition would just be like an alternative financial system where the rules are written in code and you have to follow the rules and you can't break those rules. And everything you see is transparent. So the example would be like when I was a proprietary trader, I traded in the CME. Like, I kind of knew how the execution algorithm worked, and I would see in practice how it would work when I get fills for my trades. But in reality, it's all closed end. You don't know what's going on in the back end. You don't know how you're getting allocated precisely. And so having something like this on Ethereum, having the ability to trade value in Ethereum, where it's credibly neutral, I think, in building out programs and services that are completely open and transparent, I think is a really powerful narrative. So, like, I don't think it's really fair to, like, give it, like, a kind of monetary premium by itself. And if you really felt the need to, you can just reflect that in the price multiple. Because at the end of the day, it's still a consumable asset, and what you're using it to buy is block space. And so the so what is the block space?
How
Let's
is
see ETH go a few years without a hard fork, and then the monetary premium will
There it
increase,
is.
right?
There it is. There's the Bitcoin take here. Can I ask you what this would look like if you modeled, and maybe you already have, and I haven't seen it yet, another layer one like a Solana or like an Atom? What do the numbers look like just in comparison? I've never modeled those chains out, or I've not seen a model to this extent. I have to imagine the total revenue is a lot lower, and you also have much higher dilution. So what do the numbers spit out from those layer ones, and how are they different or similar to the model that you've put forth for Ethereum?
Yeah, the idea is that we organize them according to the same first principles, the idea that they're taking revenue share and there's some kind of trickle-down effect based on how the ecosystem's structured. So something like an Ethereum, where you have a clear use case, you have a clear idea of like how it's going to accrue value and what that will be. You see what stands in the way of it getting full value capture might be like the L2. So they have to remit some portion of the total ecosystem revenue to the L2s. The same is not true for Solana. So Solana is going to be a single monetary execution layer. So under its bullish case and its bear case, I mean its base case, it logically it's going to get a higher percentage of the ecosystem take rate. And then likewise for Atom, we'll have a lower ecosystem. So Atom in its current standing, it's kind of like a it's replicated security model. Eventually it's mesh security model. But the idea is at the end of the day, you're having some sort of revenue share between the chains that are allowing Atom to validate it. And so it's more like a revenue take percentage. So under that idea, like our bull case for our Solana would be higher just because it's going to have more value capture logically under that assumption. Atom would have the lowest and that Ethereum somewhere in the middle. That's kind of
And
like the understanding.
in terms of upside, once you layer in like our top two assumptions of the penetration rate, and then if you assume that Solana takes 70% of all open source blockchain activity, the upside becomes much higher, but with a much higher level of risk as well. And the other thing that we observe, especially with Solana, is that the MEV is a much higher percentage of the revenue line, and that points to issues of centralization, right? There's opacity in that chain, fewer number of really active participants extracting value, and that it just introduces question marks. So even though we have more upside in tokens like Atom and Solana, it's smaller position sizes because of the unknowns.
Got it.
The other thing about like a Solana though is that the fact that you have a separate client being created by one of the larger proprietary trading firms in the world and Firedancer. So you really don't know like on in terms of the value capture, how Solana is going to be able to be able to capture most of the value that would Firedancer will probably be made in such a way that Jump will be able to take advantage of it, right? Like that's one of the issues with we have with MEV and Solana as well.
I see. So it doesn't necessarily mean the sole token owners will be recipients of that MEV if they're siphoned
Yeah.
off in some other way, maybe by a client or something like this.
Right. And
Understood.
also the other thing to think about is because most of the execution of an Ethereum or even Atom, it's gonna either happen on the L2s or other chains. It's like, okay, what portion of that's gonna drip down to Ethereum? That's like a big question, right? And so like the L2 political dynamic with the L1's really gonna matter, right? So at the end of the day, if like you have thousands of different L2s competing for block space to settle the Ethereum, well, then they're going to have to remit a substantial portion of the revenue to Ethereum just for that privilege, right? Otherwise, you might be seeing like one dominant L2 have like really massive margins.
It's really fascinating. It's also fascinating to consider, like, are the non-Ethereum layer ones, are they competing directly against Ethereum? There's a way in which they certainly are. Are they also competing against block space of Ethereum layer twos? There's a way in which they are as well, right? And so what are the substitutes for a non-Ethereum layer one? It's kind of a question. One other question I had for you is, like, so right now we couldn't say this in 2018 or 2019 for Ethereum, right? There was not 2 point, this is a bear market, by the way, right? $2.5 billion in annualized revenue, right? This was like minuscule back in 2018, 2019. This would have been a very, very sad analysis. Would you have published the report at that point in time? also some other layer ones are kind of like there right now, right? And the question is, can they get out of that? So I'm looking at 7-day average fees, and you have to scroll down pretty far. Binance is actually kind of impressive. I don't know if you've done a BNB sort of analysis. I know that has different dimensions entirely. Maybe we're dealing with a whole other class of asset here, but you have to scroll down before you get to like the pretty far before you get to like Solana or Avalanche used to be on here, it's not. And then what you have with some of these alternative non-Ethereum layer ones, that is a lot of daily issuance, which is kind of different from, like, there was a time where Ethereum's issuance far surpassed its revenue on the daily. And now since proof of stake and since kind of the burn mechanism, that's kind of reversed. So I'm kind of wondering about when you look at non-Ethereum layer ones and you look at kind of total revenue and you model out the cost, like it's gotta be pretty, pretty low at this point in time. You have to inject like a lot of growth assumptions on those block space sales to actually model it out. I don't know if I'm correct in this, Patrick and Matthew, but do you guys have any comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to remember that this is an asset class that still requires inflows to keep the price flat, right? Because mm-hmm. in aggregate, the whole ecosystem is inflating. And so everyone's getting diluted if they're not staking or buying more. And there are very few exceptions to that, and Ethereum seems to be one of them. So when we think about our overall macro views right now on the market, where we're pretty cautious, like we think a new inflationary normal began in 2021. It's driven by these structural underinvestments and like the most reliable and cheapest form of energies. It's exacerbated by the politics. It's breeding this disillusionment across the world, a search for alternative systems. But it's not a great time to be in risk assets right now. And so like investors around the world are focused on cash flow and what type of equities are producing cash flow. And they're not all that interested in buying really speculative long duration assets that aren't producing cash flows. And that's where, unfortunately, most of these alternative layer ones are, where it's a theoretically interesting technology. They found some level of product market fit, but not enough to be producing cash flow at scale. So we can make our assumptions about where the world may be. And in that environment, if Solana or Atom were to take that 70%, like they would be 50 baggers or more. But right now, the activity on those blockchains is not indicating that. And so we're tilted more towards the profitable blockchains, the cash flowing assets. And we're on alert for a change in the macro that would make us kind of get more aggressive around the more speculative chains.
So there you go, guys. We solved it. We know the price of ETH by 2030. It's between 350K, according to our models here. And that doesn't include monetary premium. But in all seriousness, I want to ask the question. So like, now you model something like this. What do you do with this information? How does it inform your strategy at VanEck and where you allocate? And how seriously should we treat models like this?
Yeah, we have a few different strategies. Like we have a beta strategy that aims to outperform an index of layer ones that we created. And that type of strategy would be fully invested at all times. And it tries to capture the growth in the space at a reasonable fee. And we might own like 50% ETH in a strategy like that, because we're looking for broad exposure to the space. And then we have an alpha, we might have something like an alpha strategy that aims to own like the best 20 tokens that have the most clear, the clearest value accrual and the best kind of product market fit demonstration. And then we would manage cash aggressively and try to bring down our investments when things are very, very frothy and redeploy when the market's very bearish. And in that strategy, we're focused on themes like stable coins used for payment and settlements, NFT form factors used by traditional companies, simple DeFi, decentralized physical infrastructure. And in that type of strategy, ETH might be a much smaller percentage just because of there's less upside, right? So we have like 8x upside in our base case for ETH and the model that we just went through. But in some of our, for some of our other tokens, we get to 20 to 50x upside with a lot more volatility. And so it's about kind of managing that volatility and bringing position sizes down when everyone is really optimistic and then trying to increase the position sizes when there are big drawdowns or deleveraging events.
I think the activity is really important because it gives you like an understanding, okay, like what is the potential of this system? Like how does that value look compared to where it's trading now? And then you position size accordingly. Also as a relative exercise, you say, okay, like how does this thing accrue value versus something very similar? Like what is a token economic dynamic and how does that look like when you actually put pen to paper and model it out? So I can't speak much more on that, but that's kind of how we see this. Just is an interesting
Yeah,
exercise
and
that
the
adds a lot of
ETH
value.
model, the ETH model really serves as a benchmark because in our token strategies, we're looking to outperform ETH. That's the benchmark asset. So
That's hard to
if we
do
have,
these
yeah,
days.
very hard. If you have 7 or 8 times upside on ETH, like you need to have a multiple of that to get conviction on a much smaller project.
Guys, thank you for putting together this report. It's been incredibly useful, and I was mentioning this to David in the roll-up. Like, I've not seen kind of a I would group Van Eck. I hope you're not offended by this as a traditional finance, certainly. But you guys are delving into crypto in a way that is supremely crypto native and actually understanding this asset class. And like, great work, Matthew, and kind of building this team and Patrick as the Matthew's first hire. To put this level of report out really takes some understanding of the technology and the economics and the networks that you're investing in, which I guess, I mean, your investors, that's what you'd want to do. I just want to close and ask kind of this question because it's been on my mind and on the minds of a lot of bankless listeners. So it's 2023 and we're trying to figure out where we are in the market. I've kind of called this the apathy market, the bored market. It feels like it's that part of the cycle. Some people, as they always do at this type of cycle, and maybe I'm trying to, lead the witness here, but I don't mean to. I really genuinely want to know if we get another bite at this. Does crypto make a comeback? Are we is there another bull market ahead? If so, how long out is that? Or is this kind of like, hey, that was we had crypto's big rise, and now we're sort of on the other side of that, and it'll be like there'll be some growth and some appreciation, but the biggest gains are over. What's your take on where we are? Will we get another huge uptick cycle? Maybe I'll ask you that, Matthew, since you kind of started this whole thing at Van Eck.
Yeah, but I mean, both Patrick and I left our jobs in TradFi because we believe that there's asymmetric upside in these decentralized systems, and that like an innovator's dilemma is keeping the biggest Web2 and banking companies from embracing this technology. Right now there are headwinds that are politically driven and inflation driven, but they seem to be abating right on schedule. So we're a year out from the next Bitcoin halving, and Bitcoin looks to be tracking along similar halving cycles. So it's not that hard to imagine a year from now a very different political backdrop in the US and a different environment for Bitcoin specifically. I personally think that Bitcoin is the asset like on the back of which that all these other decentralization assets, which are a spectrum, are levered to. So we think there's going to be an adoption cycle that's driven by countries outside the US, and that's likely to be most pronounced next year. So that's why we're all here is to hopefully capture the upside from that adoption cycle.
Patrick, what would you add as we close?
Yeah, I would say we're clearly in the phase of the market of the gut check where a lot of the things you believed in, a lot of the crypto lords turned out to be hollow. And going forward, I'm really encouraged by all the things that are being built and the progress being made. You don't see that reflected in the price, but the potential is enormous. There are tens of thousands of the smartest people that are working on this space, and they're trying to think and apply technology, really interesting use cases. Every single day, I'm encouraged by the things I see on Twitter, in person, with the conversations I have with the people and the interactions I've had. So I can only say it's going to be up only from here. There's going to be a lot of rocky roads. There's going to be a lot of gut checks still, but I'm extremely positive about the space going forward.
Time to test your conviction, bankless listener. And if you want that conviction tested or maybe reinforced, make sure you check out this Van Eck report. We'll include a link in the show notes. Matthew, Patrick, it's been a pleasure to have you on Bankless. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Risks and
Thank you very much.
disclaimers. You're welcome. Risen disclaimers, time for me to remind everyone, none of this has been financial advice. ETH could be 300 in a couple of years. It could be 50K. We really have no idea. Play at your own risk. Of course, all crypto is risky. You could lose what you put in, but we are headed west. This is the frontier. It's not for everyone, but we're glad you're with us on the Bankless journey. Thanks a lot.